Rico, Frank Nicomedes Pérez, unió su voz al reconocimiento colectivo del líder venezolano.
República Dominicana, en nuestro caso, no puede olvidar nunca al comandante Hugo Chávez por las acciones en favor del pueblo dominicano. Diversas manifestaciones de solidaridad. Petrocaribe es uno. Las actividades contendientes a solucionar los problemas de salud de sectores del pueblo dominicano. La construcción de casas en el municipio de Bonao son cosas que el pueblo dominicano nunca podrá olvidar del comandante Hugo Rafael Chávez Frías.
En Uruguay, el primer mandatario, José Mujica, habló del optimismo del hijo de Simón Bolívar.
Chávez era un profundo amigo de las luchas por la integración de América Latina. Era un soñador, esa gente que mira hacia adelante y ve las causas y tal vez minimiza los obstáculos, pero tiene confianza, cariño y credibilidad y lo infunde en el conjunto de los seres que lo rodean.
Por su parte, la presidenta de la República Argentina apuntó al líder venezolano venerado por su pueblo.
Uno puede ver en ese cuartel de la montaña, que es muy lindo, donde él está rodeado de barrios populares. Es como si su pueblo, los pobres, estuvieran custodiándolo. Más allá de que también lo custodia, obviamente, las Fuerzas Armadas y todo lo demás, pero a Hugo Chávez, como a Néstor y como otros, los custodian definitivamente su pueblo.
En Caracas, los presidentes Evo Morales de Bolivia y Daniel Ortega de Nicaragua unieron sus voces de reconocimiento junto a la de otros oficiales de gobierno del Caribe. El presidente venezolano Nicolás Maduro.
Que nadie se confíe, que nadie crea que ya el favor está hecho, que ya la obra está culminada, ¿no? Todo todavía está por hacer. Nuestro comandante hizo un esfuerzo mucho más allá de su propia existencia vital, de sus propias energías físicas, y nos dejó una patria con suficientes elementos para nosotros seguir abonándola. Que los hombres y mujeres de hoy, que tenemos conciencia de quién fue Chávez y de cuál es su legado y cuál es nuestra responsabilidad, tomemos su bandera y la mantengamos en alto. Ahí tenemos un pueblo que todos los días da el ejemplo, un pueblo de hombres y mujeres que todos los días da el ejemplo en el trabajo, en la disciplina, en la conciencia. Sigamos el ejemplo de Chávez y sigamos el ejemplo del pueblo de Chávez en el trabajo, en la disciplina, en la entrega y en el amor por nuestra patria. Muchas gracias, compañeros, que han venido de todas partes del mundo. Muchas gracias por tanto esfuerzo y por tanto amor. Venezuela sabrá defenderse y Venezuela sabrá seguir adelante en el camino trazado por el comandante Chávez. ¡Chávez vive!
¡Patria sigue!
¡Independencia y patria socialista!
¡Viviremos y venceremos!
Muchas gracias, compañero.
Parte del homenaje al presidente comandante Hugo Chávez incluyó la exhibición de la película Mi amigo Hugo, del cineasta estadounidense Oliver Stone. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Nuestra patria es un enclave para consagrar la vida, y es que somos la esperanza de la América Latina.
Oye, me dolió lo que pasó. ¿Cómo nos quedó el amor maltratado sin ti?
Son voces que se sumaron desde distintos rincones de Venezuela y América Latina para homenajear al comandante Chávez tras un año de su muerte.
Era necesario hacerle una canción, dedicarle unas melodías, en mi caso, que soy cantante.
Es verdad que me haces falta.
Luchar por ti es el título de esta nueva producción musical que se hizo por iniciativa de los jóvenes del primer canal juvenil de Venezuela, Ávila TV, y a la que se sumaron más de 50 creativos y artistas de la llamada Generación Chávez.
Y de alguna manera creo que eso también representa un poco la obra de Chávez, ¿no? Chávez era un hombre universal también. Su discurso no solo tuvo efecto en lo local, en Venezuela, sino que tuvo un impacto afuera muy importante.
Quiero decirte que sí quiero, que sí puedo y venceremos. Seguimos y luchamos por ti.
Esta melodía fue realizada en apenas 2 semanas y en medio de la tensión política que vive Venezuela entre un sector compuesto en su mayoría por las clases más pudientes del país que exigen un cambio de gobierno y otro compuesto por los históricamente excluidos que defienden el legado político de Chávez.
Se ha caminado, pues se ha avanzado un sinnúmero de reivindicaciones, de avances, de logros, que simplemente no podemos permitir de que esos logros se nos sean arrebatados así nomás.
Para muchos, la partida física de Chávez llevaría al fin de su proyecto político. Sin embargo, el chavismo ya ha enfrentado 3 contiendas electorales en ausencia del comandante, en las cuales ha salido victorioso.
El 8 de diciembre del año 2012, el presidente Hugo Chávez le informó a todo el pueblo venezolano que debía someterse a una nueva intervención quirúrgica por el avanzado cáncer que tenía en su cuerpo. Le pidió a todos sus seguidores estar unidos y preparados ante las nuevas adversidades. Nadie lo imaginó, pero fue su despedida.
Patria, patria, patria querida, tuyo es mi cielo, tuyo es mi sol.
Entre lágrimas y cantos, su pueblo lo llevó hasta el cuartel de la montaña, desde donde Venezuela lo conoció cuando comandó la rebelión militar del 4 de febrero de 1992 y donde hoy reposa su cuerpo. Mientras sus enemigos políticos lo presentaron ante el mundo como un autoritario y dictador, para estos jóvenes, Chávez fue más que un presidente.
Era el venezolano que más quería su país. Tú podías preguntar por cualquier rincón de Venezuela y Chávez sabía dónde quedaba. Y lo amaba profundamente, ¿no?
A Chávez lo recuerdan por sus célebres frases.
En este mismo lugar huele a azufre todavía.
Su amor a los pobres, a Venezuela, por sus actos de justicia social, sus sueños de integración latinoamericana, sus reflexiones, sus cuentos y por sus cantos. Cantos que aún inspiran a todos sus seguidores. Karen Méndez, RT.
Patria querida, tuyo es mi cielo, tuyo es mi sol. Patria, tuya es mi vida, tuya es mi alma, tuyo es mi amor.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
What's up, y'all? This is Lyrics Born in the house. I'm chilling on the Global Local with my man Sandino, baby, FRSC 101 FM. Oh!
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The Postal Service is undergoing a significant change as it moves towards Sunday parcel delivery. The announcement comes after months of debate on Capitol Hill regarding postal reform, which included not expanding, but contracting delivery by eliminating Saturday service. The program will start with Sunday delivery of Amazon.com packages and is launching in Los Angeles County and New York City. John Beaumont is president of the California State Association of Letter Carriers.
We've just hired recently approximately 35,000 career carrier assistants. Now, these are new employees. They will become career after they've been in the service for a little over 2 years after someone retires. And as they come in, these jobs, especially the Sunday jobs, a lot of them are going to the career carrier assistants. Of these career carrier assistants, almost 25% of them are United States veterans coming back from the Middle East.
He said the addition of Sunday delivery will give the Postal Service an advantage over UPS and FedEx.
Amazon.com tried to work with some of the other companies, and they didn't have the network to go ahead and handle this and get it out. So it's not like this service was offered exclusively to the post office. It actually was, I understand it was either actually to FedEx or UPS first, and our network was actually able to handle it better to get out there.
Beaumont explained that there's a misconception that the Postal Service isn't profitable. The main hurdle for the Postal Service has been a 2006 congressional mandate requiring the service to pre-fund, in only 10 years, 75 years worth of retiree health benefits.
And without having to pay that, which we didn't have to do before 2006, we would have had $600+ million in the black even during, you know, the end of this recession. So at present time, the Postal Service needs to have dramatic change. It doesn't have to do with doing away with the day of delivery. It doesn't have to do with doing away with door-to-door delivery, which they're trying to do. What it needs to do is address the law that doesn't let us pay as we go for our future retiree health benefits like we used to.
Beaumont said the letter carrier support legislation drafted by Senators Tom Udall and Bernie Sanders.
And that bill actually will address the future retiree health benefits. It will protect door-to-door delivery, and it will protect six-day delivery and allow the post office to get into new ventures.
Sunday parcel service is beginning immediately in LA and New York City and will expand to other major metropolitan areas in 2014.
Brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is union-owned, union-represented, and the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can work with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Let me tell you something. FCC agents are nothing but pure dog meat. They're just—they're nothing but the lowest form of life. FCC is probably the worst thing that ever—you know—the worst scourge that's ever come upon the face of the earth.
Heads up, eyes open, the fist clenching. Dig this. Resistance ain't dead. We still fighting back with the black, brown, and red. It's Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. coming to you live and direct. Not from no TNT or the NBC, but the POCC. At the President of Congress Committee, again coming to you live from Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freeradio.org. Keep your heads up, eyes on the fist clenched. Power to the people.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM.
Target locked on.
Pirate Radio at its finest.
There's an unlicensed broadcast station here, and we want to make sure that you stop operating.
There is?
Nothing you have heard before will prepare you for this. The sound of radio is being revolutionized by the masters.
Go!
Is anybody listening out there?
FCC, you know what that means?
Yeah. Means Federal Communications Commission. They can drive around and triangulate wherever the hell a radio signal is coming from.
Yeah, so fuck it, right? Good idea!
Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM. For freakradio.org.
Good idea!
I saw Lon Chaney walking with the Queen, doing the werewolves of London.
Yeah, I'm stoked. What's up? This is Sick Sad World, 101.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Ow!
I'm here with DJ Mickey Mouse. We are killing it tonight.
Hello.
So, I haven't done this in... Oh, this is DJ Natty Ice, by the way. BD Dubs. Haven't done this in a really... in a while. Feels good to be back. We're going to be joined by DJ Hot Nugs and DJ Dirty D later. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I had a weird interaction 15 minutes ago, but that's okay. It's over now.
I feel like awkward moments are so just vital in life. They just happen so often.
Mm-hmm. Keeps you...
And this is one of those awkward moments because we're going to have to cut this poor woman off. You are coming into Free Radio's, Evening Thursday show, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. That's my show. I'm Robert Norris, and I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. In studio, co-host, guest, and general interference expert and advisor is Michael O'Grady, who will be standing by to make pungent comments as well as offer a naturalist's advice. He apparently has a degree in such medical activities. We'll actually be interviewing him at some point in the future, but not tonight. Also coming up is Keith McHenry, Cats and Jammer Keith, as I call him, co-founder of Food Not Bombs, who has promised to call in at 6 o'clock. He's late, but then again, I'm not entirely on time myself, so I shouldn't be complaining. But stay tuned for that. Plus, some audio from yesterday's backpack bigotry fight, our protest celebration, sidewalk reclamation downtown. And you, too, can be a part of this incredible show. You can call in if you'd like, 427-3772. And away we'll go.
The only problem for only one reason that president raises the question, who owns a land? The homeless are a problem for only one reason a president raises It's just a question. Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead in the end? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a connection? Who owns the land? Who owns the imperialism? Who owns the land? Will someone please tell me? Who owns the land? I am just a white man. Who owns the land? I live in the Americas. Who owns the land? How did I get here? This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to sleep. This morning, I was awoken by a man with a handgun. He's got a book of rules that says I ain't got no right to be. Who owns the land? Who owns the land?
Who owns the land? We do, of course. And with us is that not land guy, but food guy, Keith McHenry. Hi, Keith.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm good. And you're, what are you, calling from South Carolina, where you're trying to get homeless people out of jail? What's going on with you?
No, I'm calling still from California.
You mean you're not calling from Columbia, where they've declared feeding people without a permit a crime?
Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? That they, that's one of the more recent cities. February 14th, you are supposed to apply for a permit and pay $127 a week to share food. But that group is not doing that. They're just sharing food and resisting. And the police have not confronted them yet, but they've, you know, made a point of ignoring the law. Then also, as you may know, they're attempting to pass a law banning the sharing of free food outside in public in Los Angeles. And they made a law that's similar to the Santa Cruz law, where if it's more than 70 people, 75, I think maybe 75 people, show up at an event like a Funa Bombs meal in Santa Monica, they have to have a permit. They might be waiving the fee there, but that's been debated, and they've not applied for a permit.
Keith, did you say fewer than 75 or more than 75 or what?
More than 75. It's sort of like the idea here where worse, you know, in Santa Cruz, you're supposed to get a permit if it's, what, 100 people or something?
50 people.
Or 50 people, yeah, 50
right.
people. And we never have gotten a permit here, and we had 600 people at Christmas. And then, and we regularly get over 50 people.
Oh, well, let me clarify that. No, it's
relatively rare that
you only need a permit if you're gonna do a march. If you feed people, there's as yet no requirement in Santa Cruz to get a permit. Though it may be the old injunction against Food Not Bombs and SWAP, soup without a permit, 23 years ago is still in force. I'm not sure. I don't know if it was abandoned. It's certainly never been activated since 1994 when a number of us went to jail. And I guess you were facing felony charges in San Francisco for your milk crate crime.
Yeah, my milk crate caper. Yeah.
Right.
So,
how could you dare?
Yeah, I don't know, really. I mean, it's a weird thing that there's all these limitations to free speech that are increasing across the country. And, you know, Chico was harassed for sharing food where they've been sharing food for years out of the park, but they eventually returned after the, you know, authorities tried to get rid of them. They just moved, during the initial confrontation, they were cut off guard. They moved across the street, but then they moved back in the next week. And there was threats against Sacramento Food Not Bombs, Olympia Food Not Bombs, Seattle, Portland, Raleigh, they harassed Lauderdale Lake Food Not Bombs. Police came and told them that everything would be confiscated, so they've been regrouping. They've been busting homeless people eating and, like, really viciously attacking them in Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs, but not bothering recently the local chapter there. And they banned us in Tampa and in St. Pete. Florida, but and also Daytona Beach, Florida. But they did not, actually, city council, before the Republican National Convention in Tampa, said, we've already given them enough shit, so let's just leave them alone. Because there was like a city council meeting that's how to get rid of food not bombs, and they realized that during the RNC that might not be a wise decision, so they just left us alone.
You're talking about the RNC from 2008 or 2012?
The recent one with Romney and whoever the other guy was that was running Obama.
Now, has that food not bombs actually been driven away from any cities recently that you know of?
Not driven away, but there have been, since October, there's been a number of cases where the authorities have come and told food not bombs to stop. And so that's actually been relatively common. And, in fact, it's stepped up a lot since October. First week in October, we had harassment in Sacramento, Worcester, Taos, Raleigh, and Santa Monica. And then from that time on, there's been, like, an increased number of cases. And, I mean, most dramatic is probably this one, which is an out-and-out ban that's now before the gang task force of the Los Angeles City Council. And, like, why we're part of the gang task force is, we're a gang. So we were a gang in San Francisco. We had that red book, you know, where they put our photos in. Your photo was probably put in that red book.
Cool.
Whenever they captured you, they would make an 8x10 gloss. Well, actually, it was not 8x10, but it was a pretty big photo that stuck in the red book.
They never gave it to me. I never got it.
Never got to see it? Yeah, it was cool.
No,
it was in Northern Station when you first get booked.
Yeah, you'd think after having, I was arrested at least three times in San Francisco, and I want my photo.
Yeah. Well, it's still in this book, and there is a permanent injunction in San Francisco for me. Like, I'm not allowed to be within 150 yards of any government employee or government building,
and
basically makes it illegal to be within the boundaries of San
Francisco. Have you kept strictly to obeying that injunction?
No, I ignored it ever since I had it. I never followed it even the day after I had it. I lived on Clement Street. The likelihood of a city official coming by my house was pretty high. Or me going to do anything in the whole city, like go to work. Well, you know, there's no way I was not going to be going. Or I'd go to the Anarchist Book Fair, which was in a city building with, like, city employees. I mean, what could be, that's clearly closer than 150 yards. So, yeah, I pretty much ignore that.
Well,
I try to ignore most irrational laws. I think that's the best policy.
Well, you know,
why not?
I agree with you. I'm wondering, though, that, you know, the reason I ask you if there's been any actual, either has food not bombs stopped, or I guess has anybody been arrested or cited in the last 4 months, is because it sounds like it's, again, a lot of threats that are being made, but none of these threats are being carried through on. Is that accurate or not?
Correct. What has been happening is it's this kind of funny pattern that is really working well for Food Not Bomb, because we get a lot of notoriety and a lot more support locally. But so what happens is the police come out with a bunch of cops, tell you can't do it, say they're going to take all your equipment. And then we call a protest for the very next meal, and the media comes out, more people come out and support, more people come out to eat. And then the police are, like, sheepishly looking from the sidelines and don't really do anything. And so then it blows over. But it doesn't mean that they don't continue to, you know, pass these laws and that kind of thing. So it's sort of this funny thing where it's 6 months, basically, being told that, you know, you're going to be busted, but then no one gets really busted. And even in cities like Philadelphia banned us outright. That was actually about a year and a half ago. And yet we share, you know, in three different locations in Philadelphia. Nothing's ever occurred. They never bothered us, even though they made a huge stink about it in the media and all that, and had these huge events with the mayor and all these, shelter operators and stuff like that. But nothing ended up happening. You know, it's just the craziest thing. So this is such a common pattern. It's kind of remarkable.
Well, let me ask you, what... Has this had any impact in other groups other than Food Not Bombs who may want to serve poor people food, either out of charity or out of, you know, just maybe a political motive, wanting to, you know, dramatize how abusive the, you know, bombs not food agenda is nationwide and even locally? Has it had much impact on other groups that you know of?
Yes, it actually has. So, for instance, in Raleigh, North Carolina, Food Not Bombs was one of the targets, but they also went after several churches that were sharing food in the same park. Same thing happened in Olympia, Washington, where they went after Food Not Bombs, but they also went after this church that's been doing like a street church thing. And you can see that in Seattle, a similar thing. They went after Food Not Bombs and maligned Food Not Bombs, but they were, you know, their public statements were that anybody sharing food in public. And, of course, lots of churches, there was like a pretty large rally of several hundred people outside the L.A. City Council meeting of not only Food Not Bombs activists, but also of church groups that would be affected by the ban in L.A. Houston, it was supposed to be churches and Food Not Bombs, just like in Orlando where they did the Vagabond Church and Food Not Bombs were the two targets. And what it appears to be is that they target churches because they don't want people congregating outside and eating food in public, and then they're being political pressure to provide services for the homeless. But the other aspect of it is that when you're trying to fight a First Amendment case, so there's like these things that I've heard about that are, that's too bad, that are really interesting where, you know, the time, place, manner restriction, something that we've in the First Amendment, you know, that's how they get around, like the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California, in San Francisco, the one in Atlanta, Georgia, 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. What they do is what city attorneys do, and apparently there's these city attorney meetings, like, say, the California Association of City Attorneys, where I had Arcata city attorney tell me that she had been attending those meetings when they were busing Arcata. And so they come up with this legal theory that, you know, like yelling fire in a crowded theater, if you're, you know, there can be limitations to free speech. And, of course, Orlando's interpretation was that you can only share free food and make comments about this in public at a meal twice a year per park. So it was very limited. But then that meant you could actually go out and have some free speech twice a year at a park that somebody might be in, like Lake Eola Park. But and therefore you weren't completely banned from freedom of speech. You were just banned from, freedom of speech 99% of the time. So you had that kind of issue, and that I think is one of the things that where they also go, oh, we're not discriminatory against the message of Food Not Bombs because we're jacking up these churches too.
Yeah, they're even-handed in there.
It's
even-handed abuse, Steve.
Yeah, even-handed abuse. So it's like with Vagabond Church, the pastor died like 3 years before the case got to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and there were no members of that church, and that church was gone, and there was
Well, that's really my question. My question is, has this? You say that Food Not Bombs groups throughout the country have been threatened, but have not been stopped. Have the churches been stopped?
The churches are the groups that are intimidated because often they have some property or something like that, or they don't resist. But some churches have resisted. So, for instance, the church in Olympia resisted, and the one in Raleigh posted. In fact, I got news of it. I think a lot of people got news of it because of a website from that church that got stopped. And it was only a little later I found out Food Not Bombs had been targeted earlier in the week in Raleigh. So there are some churches resisting, which is really fantastic. And also churches are becoming in solidarity with Food Not Bombs. You know, we're actually working together in cities. So, but it's a unique thing because as you can tell in the 25-year history or whatever, Food Not Bombs being jacked up, before it would be like, there's San Francisco and then you know, shortly after that, Santa Cruz. And then shortly after that, Arcata. And shortly after that, you know, Whittier. But there was never, like, all these, you know, it's very rare that there'd be all these cities. And then the next wave was when Orlando got harassed in 2008 and 2006, you know, all through that period. It was a rash of Florida cities making laws against this, but it wasn't really super widespread. The only other place was Dallas, Texas. Fort Worth, Texas had banned the sharing of free food in public. Tucson itself had banned the sharing of free food in public back in the 90s. They were one of the earliest cities to out and out ban the feeding, you know, sharing of food in public. And that's something that we had to fight. We were threatened with arrest virtually every day. And we had, you know, we were sharing meals every day when I moved there. So you had, in that case, we were fleeing the police, essentially. We had set up food. No one wanted to get arrested there because it's such harsh conditions. And so we would run with the food to try to get away. And then there was a period where we had these bicycles and bike carts, and we would race around the parks as fast as we could trying to hand out food. But that was, you know, I was like, that doesn't sound like a really workable thing. We only had a couple of arrests. We used to be on 4th Avenue near the Food Conspiracy Food Co-op. Fantastic location, but they had those ambassadors, and they would jack us up.
Where was this again?
Yellow jackets, but then the purple jackets.
Where was this again, Keith?
Tucson.
In Tucson, Arizona. Thanks. That was in 2000. And then, or maybe 98.
Actually, we actually have someone in the studio, Keith, who lived in Tucson. He brightened up when he heard that because he remembered it. Let me introduce you to Michael O'Grady. Michael, Keith McHenry.
Hi, Keith.
Hi, Michael.
Good to meet you, Keith. Yeah, I was living in Tucson, you know, for many years, and I remember your comment there on 4th Avenue. I actually helped to serve the food there, but then the police came and dispersed us, and then they opened up in another part of town. So I remember that. I was there at the time. But more than that, there's a small park just off 4th Avenue, and it's quite nice houses around there. And some complaints came up from two women who used to come there and feed the people every morning. And then they stuck a sign up there saying you can't feed. I forget the exact words of it, but you can't feed the people here in this park. I presume it was passed by the county, council.
But that was eventually changed, and Tucson does now allow people to feed Michael Keith.
Really? I don't know.
No, it's completely banned. So I had this really crazy experience because I didn't realize it was banned. No one really told me that. And so first we were getting busted, as Michael says, at, on 4th Ave, and then we moved to that little park off of 4th Ave and got jacked up there. Then we moved to what's called Speedway Park, which is, you know, there's nobody, you know, poor people live around there. I lived around there at one point. And that, we got jacked up there. So then we moved down to a park on South Tucson. We got harassed there. I mean, we moved all around town. Then we went to the courthouse and the plaza in front of the public library downtown at noon to 2. We got really harassed, particularly by what's called the downtown ambassadors, the purple shirts. But then the odd thing was we realized that once the summer came, we decided to do it at like 8 o'clock at night once the sun went down because the people eating with us said it was too damn hot to be eating with us in the middle of the day. So we go, well, that makes a ton of sense. We'll do it at night because there's a lot more people out. You know, it's not like other parts of the world that, you know, Tucson wakes up in the summer after the sun goes down. So we do it there. And the same guys that were harassing us at the library started eating with us because their bosses left at 5. They actually didn't care that we were doing it. In fact, they had no money themselves. They were poor people. That's why they were, you know, purple jackets. And so we ended up, it was like 3 months of us serving at Scott and Congress across Wigorama. And I love the name Wigorama. Yeah, eventually they defended us because they ate with us every, like, 3 times a week.
But the defense
didn't. No way they're going to bust our people. This is our dinner.
But the defense didn't hold because Tucson is, Food Not Bombs is no longer active in Tucson? Is that what's going on?
No, we share food every, like 3 times a week in Tucson.
So you have resumed your criminal behavior.
Well, it just never stopped, basically. We got busted down by the Congress Hotel. by the guy that owns that theater across the street. And that became kind of an ugly scene. So we just moved a block down to Scott and Congress. And it's just been fantastic there. And it's like a much better place. It's our banner is much more visible. The literature is much more visible. Yeah. A lot, you know, it's across from the Grill. And Wigorama.
Moving from Tucson and realizing you only have about 6 minutes left before you have to leave, since you want to be here for half an hour. It's interesting to me that the originally you did kind of a beggar's banquet thing in Cambridge, which became Food Not Bombs and was actually accepted by Cambridge. And then for about a decade, there was no expansion of Food Not Bombs until you came to San Francisco in 87, 88. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. For the first 8 years, and we were loved by the City Council of Cambridge. And, in fact, they gave us awards. They let us have a refrigerator in City Hall. It was just a really remarkable situation.
How frequently did you feed?
San Francisco was the first place we got jacked up.
How frequently did you feed in Cambridge, Keith?
Oh, every day. And plus, not only did we share food 7 days a week and did street theater seven days a week, Harvard Square, or Brattle Square technically, which is, you could see Harvard Square from Brattle Square. It's like 300 feet, less than that. The mayor would announce every week that no one need to go hungry in Cambridge because we have Food Not Bombs. We also delivered food to all these places every day in the morning. We had a refrigerator in City Hall. We got they awarded us plaques. I was nominated, I was voted a citizen of the city, and that was due to Art Agnos, that the proclamation that the city was happy.
Art Agnos was in San Francisco.
Yeah, no, it was given to Art Agnos. The city of Cambridge gave a plaque, a resolution on this leather-bound thing with like a, stamp on it, America's oldest town.
And yet Agnos and Feinstein, when they were mayors in San Francisco, immediately began the heaviest attacks on Food Not Bombs, actually to date, right, that was followed up by Jordan and perhaps to some extent by Brown, right?
I think Jordan was the worst. That's when they were like, I faced my three strikes, and that's when they were doing the violence and beating us up, and had like Leroy Lindo and those dudes that had that special task force to beat the crap out of us and stuff like that. So that's all through Jordan. There was 300 arrests under Agnos. Feinstein did start anti-homeless stuff, but she didn't attack us because she was out of office just before we started.
Did you and we're talking
Agnos,
about when these people
happened to come into power at the
we're
same.
Talking about when these people were mayors, but did you did you expect any? Why did you move to San Francisco with Food Not Bombs? Just happened to be there and start there? Were you invited there? What happened?
I had some trouble with the mafia and stuff in Boston, and I had to flee for my life. So I did that, and then as a direct result, I was just living underground for a while, and then I realized. After living underground, I was running out of money. So the thing that I decided to do was I knew at that time that I didn't want to live further north than San Francisco because it would get colder and colder and colder. And I did like San Francisco, and I lived there in the past. So that's why I moved there.
You moved there directly from...
And that was in March of 1987.
Now, you moved there...
And then my being underground was... disrupted, but when I was seen on TV at a protest at Concord Naval Weapons Station, I realized I was no longer underground. But I hadn't been bothered by the authorities or the mob for like over 12 months, actually almost 2 years by that time. So I said, "Well, okay, I'll just do Food Not Bombs now again."
What problem did you have?
Well, he was wondering what problem you had with the. The mafia? Is this one of more of your conspiracy theories, you paranoid pot smoker, you? What's going on?
No, it's a very evolved thing, which is probably not wise to talk about on illegal radio station. But anyway,
you
but
want to,
in person
you want to skip
someday
over
we
that
can
one,
go
you?
Into the details.
Have you ever discussed it anywhere? I mean, has it ever been written about? Have you ever? Or is that just sort of a
no?
Chapter?
I don't really. I mean, I have maybe mentioned it at one public gathering one time, but I don't really talk too much.
Are you afraid of
that? But I mean, at some point I probably will. But I think. So the guy that was going to kill me just was convicted and doing life in prison right now. So that's good. So I don't have to worry about that.
Of course, his brother may be on the lookout for you. So
yeah, hopefully. I think all those people went down. So that was pretty good. So,
but it
yeah,
wasn't. Well, we're not talking about a political issue. This is something else we're talking about. I'm not going to ask any more questions.
It was kind of political. I mean, it was partially because the mob was. You know, I was sharing food outside the World Series and the playoff game to the Red Sox, and they were trying to gentrify this neighborhood, and it was a merchants association and stuff like that. So it was like that kind of thing. You know, WGBH Radio and the Phoenix newspaper came to do an interview about this protest that we were doing. Because they were trying, this was the Broken Window Studies, was one of the first quality of life enforcement, efforts, and it was before the World Series, and they were trying to drive the homeless out of Kenmore Square, which is where Fenway Park is. And I lived there, and I had a business there, and I had 12 employees there, and I worked for the Red Sox, and so I was approached to make a poster where I was supposed to take a photograph of this black guy, that's what they called him, and make a red circle with a red line through it and say wanted out of Kenmore Square. But the reality was that this black guy, as they called him, was our best friend, Mr. Butch, and his nickname was the King of Kenmore Square or the Mayor of Kenmore Square, and everybody loved him. And he basically was like, he looked just like Jimi Hendrix, and he had been beaten by the police at a concert and had gone simple. So he had like this really beautiful, simplistic, you know, just very touching, innocent way about him. And he would just stand in front of Captain Nemo's Pizza where 30,000 people would walk by on their way to every Red Sox game. And he would kiss babies and, you know, and he would greet everyone. Everyone just loved him. He had this big, beautiful smile. He helped people get out of the snow in the winter. And he was just like this amazing guy that, you know, and he would come to my house every Friday. My wife would make sure he had to soak his feet. She had this real thing about, you know, he should put his feet in hot water in my bathtub. And, you know, and then we'd give him dinner and party with him all night. And then we'd known Mr. Butch for like 10 years. And we knew all his girlfriends and all that stuff. He was just an icon of the neighborhood. And we just said, no, we're not like going to try to kick Mr. Butch out. That's ridiculous. And I offered to feed all the hungry, you know, because we were friends with all the people living in that neighborhood. It was a great neighborhood to be a homeless person, right? Because you had 30,000 fans come by like, you know, like 300 times in a year, you know. It was great, or whatever it was. I don't know what it was, maybe 100 times in a year, whatever the number of games are in the home games for Red Sox in two seasons. So it was like a cool thing. And I loved working for the Red Sox. I made all their stuff. You know, I made the World Series pennant stuff and the American League pennant stuff. So unfortunately, though, it turned out all those people connected to all that are really actually the mafia, which I did not know at the time. I suspect as much, but I didn't, you know, it didn't bother me. I was just making posters, calendars, pennants, T-shirts, you know, stuff like that, ads in newspapers. But then it became like kind of a problem because, you know, I refused to cooperate in driving the homeless out of there. And we wrote a letter, and I had an ex-girlfriend that was an editor of a local newspaper, and she published this letter that we wrote to the business association denouncing these policies of targeting the homeless and maligning people. So then we were doing this thing called Welcome to Kenmore Square before every playoff game and every, you know, every World Series game and against the Mets, you know, the Red Sox against the Mets, home games. And it was a wonderful thing. About half the neighborhood signed a petition supporting the rights of the homeless. Other people were, you know, desperate to get rid of the homeless, thinking we could become a rich neighborhood like Newbury Street, which was their model. So that would be like Madison Avenue in Manhattan. That would be like, I don't know, Union Street and, you know, in the marina, something like that. Pacific, in Santa Cruz. So, you know, that was never going to happen. It was like, you know, college kids, pizza places, Fenway Park, you know, they had a great character, had punk bands playing at the Rat Skelter, all that. But then they systematically shut down all the businesses, including mine. I got evicted. I had all my people broke into my office, stole all my files. All my customers were threatened. My lawyer was threatened with death on a conference call I was having with him and the attorney for the mob and all that stuff. So it got really crazy. I got indicted, things like that. And then Phoenix and WGBH came to my apartment to interview me about this campaign, and the first question both of them asked on December 16th of whatever that year was, 1986, said, well, we got called this morning that somebody's going to kill you. What do you think about that? And I got two media people asking me that, the first two interviews I had that day, and I go, wow, that does not sound good. And then sure enough, the next morning, about 50 cops show up to my office, and my apartment was across the street. And I'd been already told by the district attorney that he had people in prison that could do him favors if I got in prison, and, you know, that there's no death penalty there, so they could kill me in prison. Or they could kill me out of prison because he had some friends that, you know, could do him favors on the outside and so on. And when all this came down, we realized we had to go underground. So that's what we did. And we went to the U.S.-Mexican border and lived in the back of a truck for like a year. And that's what happened.
Wow, so this is the first time we have an exclusive story. I shall be contacting my mafia buddies in Boston to pass
on
the word.
Well, the Bolger case, which just got settled, he was the dude that was supposed to knock me off. He had actually himself fled. He was a double agent. He worked for both the FBI, and he killed 63 people in Boston. And he was the guy that that the district attorney was for Suffolk County was referring to. So anyway, that's what turned out happened. And so the FBI was, you know, it's allegedly you can do any crime as a confidential informant, infiltrating the mob or activist groups and stuff, except for you cannot kill people. That's supposedly the one rule. And but the FBI, you know, actually wiretapped and monitored and, you know, and the whole thing of him killing 63 people while he was working for them. So the taxpayers were paying this dude to knock off people. And that's technically illegal. So the FBI agents got in trouble. He got in trouble, all that. So
yeah, but
that whole crew is in prison now.
This is,
so
certainly, this is certainly cheaper than drones. I mean, we've become far more upscale. So I think, I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah, it's not gone high tech. That's
well,
cool.
You know, you know
another thing that we're promoting over here, actually, is this thing trying to get the NDAA, you know, to have like a constitutional protection zone where, and so if you come to the Food Up Bonds meal on Saturday or Sundays, now we do Saturdays and Sundays at 4 at the downtown post office, and we have a petition and we're to the city council, and this is something Danny Sheehan has initiated, a local attorney who's famous for Pentagon Papers and Iran-Contra, Silkwood, many other things, American Indian Movement, Black Panthers,
UFOs.
And so he's, this idea is that, the local authorities would, supposedly defend us if the military comes in and starts matching people like they're legally allowed to, according to the legislation signed by Obama at midnight Hawaii time on on December 31st of 2010, I believe it was.
Yeah, and it was renewed recently, and there have been some states that have tried to opt out of the NDAA. But Food and Rob Bombs locally is something you've not only been involved with helping to expand that and, you know, I think beef it up. There's actually a banner that shows up there now that might not have been there as frequently, and a literature table, which wasn't there at all, I don't think, before. You hit
really
town.
Cranking.
But, I mean, you also mentioned your solidarity with the Santa Cruz 11, who recently had their trial postponed in another, I won't call it a bonehead move, but certainly a political move by the district attorney's office to disqualify Burdick, who's not my favorite judge, but probably better than the others in the Santa Cruz 11 case, mainly because he's really tired of seeing his courts taken up with this political crap that there's no there's less and less guarantee of even winning in terms of had there being a conviction of the, these are the people who occupied the 75 River Street place, for those who are listening and don't know, with the Occupy Santa Cruz group, and they were then attacked, not because they did anything inside the building. Others created some property damage there that had to be repainted. They had to clean out some, I think, the room where people took a dump, and they also with some broken furniture. But, you know, the idea that, you know, the building is still standing, it's you know, it's still vacant. It was vacant then. You have, you know, pointed out, and you pointed out then, and actually have written about it, that the issue that they were raising, well, a couple of issues, community center, place for the homeless, but also the building was leased by Wells Fargo Bank, and Wells Fargo is one of the, if not the biggest foreclosure fraudster in the country. You talked last time I spoke with you, or one of the earlier times, about doing some research into the foreclosure fraud actually happening in Santa Cruz County, which, you know, has been ignored in the focus on the so-called vandalism or trespass by the people selected by the police and the district attorney to target. Any updates on that?
Well, we actually, there's now three people doing research to get the exact dollar amount. Oh, I've got to go here in a second, but I'll finish up. So the exact dollar amount we're going to get, we have like a crew working on that, going to courthouse and stuff. And what we think is in millions of dollars for sure. We know a couple of properties are a few million dollars that were foreclosed on. And before, you know, that pretty much adds up pretty quickly. So our, you know, we want to have that dollar amount because really the basic bottom line issue of this whole case is not like who took over the building and stuff like that. The real thing is that a couple of points. First of all, the TARP program, Wells Fargo's leadership, and this is in a federal case that's in Massachusetts right now, a whistleblower came forward and said that the foreclosure crisis was part of an agreement between the Obama administration and the banks, that the taxpayers have given them billions of dollars and to bail them out if the Obama administration started the HOPE program, and then the banks, including Wells Fargo, but also J.P. Morgan and the others, would then seize as much property in America as they humanly could. And they took millions of pieces of property from families in this coordinated effort. And so I'm getting details from that trial. It's pretty outrageous. I heard this same story like dozens of times. I even have it in my book, Hungry for Peace. I opened with that from a friend of mine who was the first, one of the earliest people I met that went through the HOPE program, lost their house. So then they, and also lost their marriage and, you know, and all that. And so then, in Santa Cruz though, there was a conspiracy between the county, to red tag houses and if they couldn't seize the house, if Wells Fargo or other banks could not seize the house, through the HOPE program, they would then red tag them. And I met like, probably a couple dozen people in this county who lost their houses to that, including a Silicon Valley realtor who lost two properties to this, both in Santa Clara County, red-tagged a mansion that she owned, and a huge property in Santa Cruz was red-tagged, and her house was seized. And it was all the same concept of a collusion between the banks, her case, Wells Fargo, and the county. And so there's also an Aptos, the guy had a mansion over the ocean. He was so distraught, and I have this in that article, he committed suicide after years of litigation and received a form letter from Wells Fargo. So it's in the millions of dollars, just in Santa Cruz County, of buildings of people's private homes who were seized by Wells Fargo. And so, you know, here Wells Fargo is trying to get $25,000 from the activist community for the occupation of this building, when the people of Santa Cruz County have lost millions of dollars worth of property, and we want to get the exact dollar amount of that. And then it's not even like, it's very little money that Wells Fargo contributes to nonprofit groups in the county, and so we've got that statistic. So the comparison between the amount of theft, intentional fraudulent, theft of people's homes, which then caused families to break up, people to commit suicide, people to become homeless, people to suffer horribly, emotional breakdowns, health crises, all these things occurred as a direct result of a conscious campaign by Wells Fargo Bank. And so the amount of money that's stolen by Wells Fargo Bank, but the district attorney, who is, for some stupid reason, we are paying to represent one of the richest corporations in the world, against our own people. They don't have their own lawyer. Their own lawyer should be litigating for the $25,000, not our own district attorney. But that same district attorney did not prosecute Wells Fargo Bank for the theft of millions of dollars worth of property. And so that's really where this whole thing's at. You know, you have criminals, Wells Fargo Bank, that went out intentionally stealing homes all over the county and driving people into the grave, into health crises, and destroying marriages and families. You know, like, you know, in my book, Mary, her children ended up having like severe emotional problems because of the foreclosure of their home. And the marriage broke up, and she's been homeless. Mary herself's homeless to this day. Her husband is barely hanging in and renting from another foreclosed family that, you know, like, with just giving them money, even though they've lost the property themselves, and he's waiting to be evicted when the bank finally seizes that house that he's renting. You know, it's just sick, and I can tell story after story of that. So that's really where the issue is, and I am hoping to do an update on that article before the you know, next court appearance, and I'm going to make flyers of this, and we're going to post this, you know, stuff all around town. And I think that needs to be the focus. So the crimes of Wells Fargo are far more egregious than any, you know, than the First Amendment activities that were did to try to point out the crimes of Wells Fargo.
And you
so
felt,
that, you know, and so that's just.
I think you felt so strongly about this that you suggested the best strategy was not to get lost in the legalisms of the, you know, 2-year now long legal maze and labyrinth, but to actually reoccupy places like the vacant bank. I think you at one point suggested
correct.
That.
Yeah, I think we should do that. We need to be proactive because, like in my three strikes case, it was not the law that made any difference. The evidence was just manipulated by the state. The whole thing was phony. I got framed on 3 violent and serious felonies and 47 felony conspiracy cases. But the only reason we won is we kept organizing politically, saying, look, at the crime is you're letting thousands of people go hungry in your city, and then you're beating people up for trying to feed them, and you're allowing Bank of America and Bechtel and Raytheon and Lockheed to rob the American public of billions of dollars to build weapon systems we don't need while your people are starving on the streets. You know, that was the whole crime there. But not whether I had, you know, 24 milk crates that I, of course, would have returned to the vegetarian restaurant as I had done every single night for, like, you know, 5 years. No, it was like, the real criminal was Frank Jordan. It was the corporate executives that were destroying our country. I mean, that's really where it's at. And so we need a total uprising, needless to say. And that's where the focus should be, not on, you know, like, who's the, you know, even to entertain the idea of the activist community, we can use $25,000. Imagine if the activist community in the city had $25,000, we could really crank. But, you know, Wells Fargo doesn't need $25,000. They're like the, if not the wealthiest corporation on earth, they're one of the wealthiest corporations on earth. And they're the one of the wealthiest corporations on earth because they stole all our property all across America and robbed us at, you know, gunpoint, sending sheriffs with guns to take our home.
In Santa Cruz, Keith, there was, of course, a lot of fear as a consequence of these prosecutions. This is the first time you've had been charged with felonies before. But this is the first time that I've heard that activists in Santa Cruz, perhaps with the exception of animal rights activists, because I think there was some of that, but and maybe environmental activists too, but at least, you know, activists around downtown protests have gotten charged with felonies. That resulted in a lot of people being scared to say and to wear the T-shirt I am now, well, I was wearing yesterday, which said, I was in the building.
I can see how people get, and it's more and more frightening to face felonies all the time. And I have to say, when I faced life in prison, I was a damn nervous wreck. But but still, I mean, there's such a corrupt government and such a corrupt economic system that, you know, I mean, the reality is that we're facing being murdered by these people. So, you know, that's really the, you know. So, like, even 20, 30 years in prison. And, I mean, you look at 40 years for Black Panthers, some of them will never get out. They didn't do any more than what we're doing. So, no, it certainly is, you know, in America, the threat of being in prison for political ideas is definitely severe. But, you know, we just have to be, sadly, we have to be stronger and resist.
We've been talking with Keith McHenry.
The project I'm supposed to be working at is just started. So, but, I'll be around for 2 months, so I'll be able to eventually get into the studio.
So how can people
spend more time?
Yeah, that I'd like to see you and be, you know, we usually
have a good time, and I can actually cut you off without letting you go on and on. Of course, then you can try to cut me off. We can cut each other off. How can people get involved with local Food Not Bombs? I suppose foodnotbombs.net or santacruzfoodnotbombs.net, or what is it?
It's santacruzfoodnotbombs.org.
.org.
And then the other thing they can do is go. We have a meeting at Little Red Church on Center every Tuesday at 5:30. And in the building, the little room across the daycare center building. And then the other thing is every Saturday and Sunday at 4, we share food. And we're looking for musicians and poets and stuff to come out. And, you know, to sort of protest the street performers band that's happening in solidarity with us every Saturday and Sunday, 4 o'clock at the downtown post office.
You want to make
any... You need cooks and stuff like that.
You want to make any statements about the backpack bigotry issues that you may have heard about?
The what issue?
No, you haven't. You bad man. We did protests yesterday, and for the last couple of weeks, we've been raising the issue. HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, around that of cafes that are denying people with backpacks entrance.
Oh, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about that, but that's pretty stupid. You know, people should be allowed in to places.
Yep.
I mean, there's a whole general right wing crazy clampdown on this. In the state, let alone in the whole country, let alone just Santa Cruz is really going backwards, you know. So, yeah, I think we have to resist that. We should resist all these things. We have to, you know, I did have some good news, but I do have to go. And the good news is that the far left won in the mayor's race and city council race in Taos, New Mexico, where I actually have a farm. And that is really amazing because this meant that the Spanish, which usually do not work with the Anglo community, actually united with the Anglo community, and we actually got 2 votes to every one of the incumbent, and with landslide, and that's gonna, so there's like this kind of grassroots revolt happening in some places. So that's what needs to happen here. We have to throw out all these city councilors and the mayor and everything, and then put in actual like normal people into power. So that, you know, I'm not going to run for office because I don't have the time to do something like that. But we should find people that should run for office. And in a little town like this, you could easily overwhelm the city council and have it be all, you know, radicals. And that's something that definitely should happen. And then that way, you know, then we can abolish all these laws, get rid of this license plate reading stuff, you know, all this crazy fascism that's happening here.
Keith McHenry.
Anyway, and then also you can call me at 575-770-3377 or go to foodnotbombs.net and all my contact information is there. And there's links to Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs.
Okie dokie. Well,
there you go. Well, I'll talk to you soon, man. Take care.
Hey, thanks.
Have fun.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs, co-founder and updater. Thank you, Keith. And Michael, any thoughts here from what you've heard? Are you...
He's Keith McHenry. He's obviously a very great person. I saw him, met him once, but you know, we need more people like that around. Very positive, able to stand up to some of the forces, negative forces around. Yeah, good old Keith.
Yeah, I don't know about this push to take over the city council. I've always been somewhat sarcastic and skeptical about such things, but hey. I'll keep looking, and we'll see what's happening. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and this is Bathrob Spears Broadsides. In the studio with me is Michael O'Grady, man of the streets, persona non grata at the Abbey Cafe. Or have you gone back to double-check on that?
No, I haven't gone back, but I do intend to still go to the management up there and talk to them, basically. You know, now I'm without my beard and my hair is a little shorter.
Oh, you're a little more
so,
conventional looking.
I won't be
wear a business suit, perhaps.
I won't be confused.
You look normal.
So easy.
Normal.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. You know, have your Take Back Santa Cruz button perhaps on. I don't know if that. I would say just walk in again, order a cup of coffee, and sit down and see what the response is. If you want to deal with the emotional turmoil that might come anyway.
Yeah,
and bring somebody with you who has a video camera or some, you know, camera capability on their phone.
Well, that's a possibility, but I'm not going to do that right away. I've got a few other things to do before that.
Mm.
Well, I want to remind folks that if you want to call into the station, if you have questions, I should have, of course, mentioned this when Keith was talking, but I could barely get a question in edgewise. I should have been dialing down his mic more, I think, and heard it, tried to interrupt and direct. But he had so much to say that I wanted him to be able to go on and say what he said. I will no doubt be criticized for differential behavior in that regard, but so be it. You can, however, call in and risk getting dialed down or dialed up or questioned or say whatever you want. 427-3772 is the call-in number, 831-427-3772. I'm going to take a brief musical break, and I'll be back and playing some of the more recent interviews, which Sir William Blake, one of the local activists, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom activists, has been getting on the streets. He's been running around with a tape recorder. And watch out. There are a lot of people be running around with tape recorders all the time. Maybe even audio players. Or maybe even video. Who knows? It could be a coming thing. In any case, I do encourage people, when you see instances happening on the street that are abuses, don't wait for the police department's professional standards internal affairs department to write you off, or the mayor to ignore you, but post it on YouTube with your commentary and the witnesses present. We have a caller here. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert and Mike.
Well, hi, Uncle Robert. Hi, Mike. This is David Silva.
Hey, David.
Hi, David.
I'm just calling to see if there's anybody that wants to organize events. I'm willing to help as much as I can. You know, I'm off again on again because of my health, but I'd like to get, you know, jumpstart some more events and more demonstrations. And my theme will be that I will be the one that's dancing, and anybody who wants to follow me dancing, if we have a parade, I promise you, Robert, the next parade we have, I will dance the whole parade.
My goodness. Well, I know you're doing some heavy, you were standing on a podium yesterday downtown in the protest against backpack bigotry.
That was fun, being up on that podium up high like that. Well, it was fun.
Yeah, you could just...
So many people were... I mean, it was like... Well, it was really good, Robert, about carrying sign and holding a sign yesterday, is that the majority of people, all you do is give them like a 1 to 3 sentence, simple sentence explanation of what you're doing, and they do really agree with you. The few that disagree with you have some kind of like past store ownership meeting alliances that they don't think, you know, they really think there is a problem that, you know. But other than those few, the city seemed to be really behind us. It was really good feeling. Mm. And thank you for making it happen, Robert. You know, I'm on board whenever I can be. And it was a great show today, by the way.
Yeah, you can thank Keith and, of course, Mike here for that. And thank me as well, of course.
Well, you know, for any day now, I'm going to get my... are you still there?
I am.
Yeah, I'll be getting my new veterans claim, and so I'll be a little bit more comfortable, able to start actually doing things. I love to go to movies. Anybody wants to go to a movie, I'm always willing to take somebody to a movie.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And I'm going to be traveling around the world seeing the Portuguese ports of the world.
Well, don't forget to do your update, which we keep hoping you're going to do, on the vets. We want to let homeless vets what the situation is, what's happening at the vets' hall. So if you can get in touch with that, because that would be helpful for us.
Well, this move from to put into just one office downtown, it's nice that the place has opened up again, but it was really nice for a lot of county veterans that there was a 41st office and a downtown office. It made it much more convenient for a lot of, you know, veterans. Most of them don't have very much money, let's face it. So, you know, anything you make it easier for them, you know, instead of costing you $6 to go try to get some arrangements with veterans, you know, you could just be able to walk. But, you know me, I'll walk anyway. But still, a lot of veterans, you know, count on having to ride a bus to go places. And it just was, the shutting the office is the only thing negative I can say about the Veterans Administration right now. Uncle Robert, I really encourage any veteran out there, if you've been discouraged by the Veterans Administration in the past, it just ain't the same. There's much more, you know, happening, much more response. Plus, many of us were discharged under false pretenses. They made bogus deals with us and so forth just to get us out or whatever. Those of you that have those kind of things are bad charges. Go in and talk to your Veterans Administration. You'll find out that there are some new laws that, you know, if you reported that you'd been raped 3 winters in a row and hospitalized for rape, and then you finally stood up for yourself the fourth winter, you report something like that, you know, when you're on your discharge, they will handle the discharge right nowadays, supposedly. But, you know, for people like me, it was never handled right. I was almost given a...
You know, we'll believe that, David, when your money comes... You know, we'll believe that when your money comes... We'll believe that when your money comes through, so...
Finally seeing the world, and I'll give you reports from around the world. How's that?
Sounds good, and in the meantime, you take care and keep listening and let us know what you think.
Okay. And just know that Santa Cruz will always be my home, and I'm going to be bragging about how well we do, but how hard it seems to be for us to take care of this homeless problem. It just only seems to be really getting uglier. I think it's because too many people think things were okay because you're in a progressive town. Hell no, we're not in a progressive town. Let's get over that illusion now, folks. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, David. And indeed, after this brief musical break, I'm going to see if I can get a hold of Bob Patton, who we had on the air earlier. He was the president of the, I think it's United Veterans Council. I could have that wrong. He was talking about new problems at the Vets Hall where a sort of semi-military, I guess the Vets, what would you expect, but apparently less than the Vets appreciate, or more than the Vets appreciate, I should say, regime had taken over there, and he wanted to, he was trying to organize against it and publicize the problems. Maybe we can get an update from him. Phone lines here will be open, 427-3772. Five singing Food Not Bombs. And of course, you're still tuned to 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and the studio with me is Mike O'Grady. And the call number here, in case you want to, is 427-3772. Mike, you had some thoughts about
there was two things
backpack
on my,
bigotry?
Yeah, two things on my mind right now. You just mentioned about your demonstration about the way the restaurants treat the homeless people. I wonder if you knew in I don't know if it was Portland or Eugene or one of those places, they actually have their own restaurant.
Sisters
for
of the Road.
Yeah, that's it. That's Portland, so you do know about it. Okay.
I've been there, actually.
Does it work out well?
Well, it was 15 years ago. I don't know how they're doing now.
Yeah,
You know, it was a low-maintenance kind of place that I remember. I don't remember a lot about it, but I think it may still be open. I'm not sure what the current status is. So it's, and, you know, I don't know. I shouldn't have to have your own little segregated restaurant.
No, no, you don't. Unless the behavior on the culture of homeless people is too crude for some people.
I'm sorry. You raised that issue before, and I really disagree with you on that. But go ahead. I mean, feel free to express your thoughts.
I don't know how.
I know you want to change. Sir William Blake, whose interviews we're about to hear. He's not really a lord, but that's what he calls himself, Sir William Blake. But he's a lord of a guy, I got to say.
Yeah.
He feels similarly with you that, you know, the homeless people are, you know, there are a lot of behavioral problems that they have to address. And, you know, why don't they shape up? And, you know, they bear responsibility for their situation. And, you know, I think everyone bears responsibility for his own situation.
No, they're in need of healing.
But the problems I talk about have to do with oppression.
They don't
have to do with healing.
No, nothing wrong about
this business about sending in social workers and psychiatrists. I don't go for that. Unless people want them.
I have a background as a medical doctor and naturopath.
You don't want to let that control you here as medical doctor.
But it's an experience.
Your human background is more important to me.
Basically, they're in need of healing. They argue. They have a lot of anger issues. They argue a lot. They're in need of healing. One thing. But you know about that restaurant. I don't have any other
facts.
Not recently.
Yeah. But, you know, I was there once, many years ago.
Right.
Sisters of the Road. If folks are interested, they can go online, probably read about it. It is in Portland. I mean, Portland has really had an expanded and very vibrant homeless activist culture. I mean, they have a newspaper there that probably is the biggest in the country. Mm. It's called Street Roots, and you can find it online.
Maybe we should study them and apply some of the positive
Well, they're a larger city, and it's always true in larger cities you get at least more people who are interested in these issues,
right.
And also more people usually who are being oppressed, and therefore it can be encouraged to form coalitions on these issues. San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland. Santa Cruz, you have a heavily gentrified community that is growing, you know, more and more gated in its own way. And also it's I don't know if it's fair to characterize I don't think Tepic Santa Cruz is necessarily a wealthy movement, though I don't think anyone's done a class analysis of it, you know, what the income is, where the money is coming from. I've heard some claims that there are a few deep pockets here and there, you know, that are dealing with it. But I think
Keith Matt Henry was saying in his talk that the wealthy people were against the homeless more, I don't know, in Boston or wherever he was referring to.
He talked about a divided neighborhood. When he was forced out of town in 1986, and he said that half the neighborhood was really supportive of this guy, you know, this African-American who'd been beaten by the police.
But he also said the wealthy people were more against the homeless.
He said half the neighborhood was against it because they aspired. They might not necessarily have been wealthy, but they wanted to see a neighborhood that was wealthier, you know, and seemed to be safer because it had less visible poverty. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is always a temptation in any city that people will want to do this. Mm-hmm. And I feel it's a temptation that has to be fought. You don't change things by cosmetically removing the individuals involved or criminalizing them or locking them up or declaring them mentally ill or tranquilizing them and dumping them in psych wards or you know, any of these kinds of social control measures. Although that
they do have they in this
satisfies
country,
some,
they do dump them into jails.
There's 5150s too that are happening, and sometimes I'm not saying these things are always wrong or always unjustified, but the massive focus on these solutions by such falsely named groups as the Public Safety Task Force, you know, and the Santa Cruz Police Department's attempt at the highest levels, Deputy Chief Clark, to characterize homeless crime as some kind of dangerous crime wave that's eating up the public budget, when in fact they have created this by cooking up laws that they are then running around enforcing around homeless survival behavior, like sleeping, like sitting down on the Pacific Avenue, like being in a park after dark, like sleeping under a bridge to get out of the rain. These kinds of behaviors are necessary human behaviors. I mean, even, you know, obviously it's outrageous that they go after people for this, but even if you don't think it's outrageous, it's it's economically ridiculous to suggest that people are not going to be doing these things. Mm-hmm. I suppose you can terrify them. Mm-hmm. You know, if you really put you know, you are, they are driving away the street performers, mm-hmm. according to commentary I've heard from downtown, though I still see the occasional street performer down there. And I was going to suggest that street performers who come to town, like this month, there's a picture on the Good Times of Steve Martin, who I know is a comedian and a movie star rather than a street performer, but he's coming to do some show. Mm-hmm. I would encourage that people like Tom Noddy, who are world-famous performers, and the great Morgani, to contact these people and suggest that they do a set on the street, mm-hmm. and they do it in a way, they don't get a permit, they do it exactly like Morgani did, and they essentially act in solidarity with other performers who are poorer. By that I mean not necessarily
and
worse,
risk getting a
less
ticket.
Economically well off.
Risk getting a ticket from
yeah,
the
and
local
also,
police.
And have, that would change things very quickly. Mm-hmm. Santa Cruz would become a laughing stock, and that exactly. I think is not something that they want. Although, with these hard-nosed characters in, you know, on the city council, it's a little hard to tell what their reaction would be. Do you have something else you wanted to say?
No, mm-hmm. I met a woman this week, and I don't know how long ago. I don't think I asked her. I presume it was a year or two ago. It was a while ago, anyway. And she had flown in from Hawaii, and the ticket was on her bag, Hawaii. And she met a. She was looking for a motel or a hotel somewhere to stay, and she got a ticket from a policeman here for having no address. Is that possible?
It's not a crime, as far as I know.
Yeah,
she was probably for something else, or maybe she refused to give her address. I can speculate. I don't know. But as far as I know, there's no such crime. Although, police officers can be very peculiar at times,
they
don't necessarily. They sometimes get carried away with their own authority, particularly if people object to what they're doing.
Right. Well, she's an independent lady, quite sane, you know, in all respects. So when I see her again, I'll
get the details.
I'll get the details.
Try to find out what the disposition of the ticket was, if she knows what the actual.
I told her to call
were.
Into the radio station here. Mm. I gave you your ticket, actually.
Oh, my card?
For your card.
If anyone wants to call in, I want to remind you, you can either call in off air on the Huff line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF, which is 423-4833, or you can call the studio. Our lines are open now, next 50 minutes, and that's at 427-3772, 427-3772. Let's take that famous, actually, we did take the musical Blake, a break. Now let's take an unmusical Blake. We got Sir William Blake here, who has been out interviewing people on the streets. He passed me this tape, which I'm going to play largely unheard. So this is going to be a surprise for me as well as for you. We'll see if we get into any trouble with this tape. But let's just hear what he got from the streets.
This is Sir William Blake, not even having his first damn cup of coffee, but waking up, what the hell, on the streets with?
Most people just call me Kid.
Okay, and could you tell me what happened?
Well, the other morning, my dog ran away, and I chased after her, and I restrained her. She broke off her collar somehow. So I'm restraining her, and I have, like, three cop cars roll up, and they arrest me for animal abuse for restraining my dog. So I can get my jacket off and try to make a makeshift leash. So they arrest me. They wouldn't let me get my shoes. They wouldn't let me get my gear. So now I have no gear. And they wouldn't give my dog to my friend. They were going to take my dog down to the shelter or the pound or wherever they bring her. And they end up losing my dog. They refused to give me any information the whole time I was there. And when they tell me I lost my dog and I start flipping out, they try to tell me I have emotional problems. Seriously, emotional problems because I'm
violating
worried about my dog?
Rights. Violating your rights.
Exactly.
Hey, violating your rights, all your rights, a lot of rights.
I got out yesterday at around 3 o'clock, and my dog was never caught. I was looking all day for her, and I was at my wit's end. People saw me crying on Pacific. And eventually I just wandered over to the levee and sat down, and she ran up to me and gave me a flying headbutt to the face, and I got her back. She found me.
That's amazing.
But you know what?
That's amazing, though.
They
but
still,
it shouldn't have gone down that way. It shouldn't have gone down that way.
They still lost my dog for a few days. She was out there by herself.
Yeah.
You know, I had a few people that I know on the street said they tried to catch her, but to no avail. She was out there by herself, and the cops didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
You know.
But you sure gave me a ticket for sitting on a fucking curb of a planter.
Yeah.
Not even a planter.
Less than 4 hours ago, they gave me a ticket for trying to stay dry under a bridge. You know?
After you already been through the fucking ordeal that you've been through.
Yeah.
Ain't that a bunch of shit?
And while I was asking to get all my stuff, if I can grab my shoes, this older cop starts making fun of me. He calls me a stinky bastard. You know, I'm just trying to get my shoes. Like, right now, as I'm talking, I have no shoes.
Well, to me, it sounds like you ought to get, you know, some attorney from the ACLU, because, you know what? That sounds like a nice lawsuit.
Like, honestly?
Well, no, it does sound like a nice lawsuit.
It does, because
it's all totally against your rights.
Yeah.
And if it was me, I'd go to the ACLU.
Honestly, I don't even think I'm going to stay here that long. The cops have pretty much driven me out. I'm going to leave town as soon as possible.
I wouldn't let them do it. I'm serious. They, you know, there's people in this town that want me driven out, and I'm not being driven.
Yeah.
And some of them are tough. Some of them are tough, but you know what? And the cops look after me, looking at me all the time and studying me, because they know I do protests, yeah. But the thing is, I'm not leaving, because, you know, I'll leave. Whenever I leave something, I leave when I want to leave. And that's just the way that is.
Mm-hmm.
If I want
See, it's a performer. I asked him earlier, because he's within 14 feet of the building, and he said that he had written permission from the business owner to be there. So I suppose he's okay. I don't know if the ordinance has some loophole about that that I don't know about.
This sounds like Kate Wenzel, who is a famous scarf lady we've had on the air before. No, she's mistaken. You can't get permission to be on the public sidewalk. Except from presumably you might be able to get a special permit from the city council, or from Parks and Rec, or you might get an extended permit to be able to be there beyond an hour in a very limited way through the permit process at Parks and Rec. But the businesses do not have the right to permit you to be in front of them. I mean, they can applaud your work, they can tell the police they love it. They can actually have you perform on their property, for example. Now, if you're in Dell Williams Jewelers, if you're familiar with it, which is right next to the Coffee Roasting Company, and you're actually in their alcove, that is legal because it's their property. But they can't say, you know, there's really a misunderstood notion that if you somehow have the permission of a shop owner, you can be in front of their property in the public sidewalk. You can't. This has been made illegal by the city council, and it has... It has been done, of course, as part of an anti-homeless, anti-youth kind of thing, and also an idea of giving the police greater powers. Essentially, it was a response to a series of hysterical and zealous attacks on street culture by a woman named Candy Jackson of Jackson Shoes, when there was a thing called Jackson Shoes, now called Oh My Soul, I believe, downtown on Pacific Avenue. And I think I've got the right business. Hope I'm not mistaken on that. But I know it was Jackson of Jackson Shoes. And she proposed a series of draconian responses to get rid of, I guess, a street performer nearby her that she didn't like. At the time, there was a general process for dealing with street performers in a voluntary way that seemed to be working pretty well. And there was never any attempt to mediate. It was just her attempt to... ram through anti-homeless ordinances, which was very successful in the summer of 2002. And Tom Noddy, the bubble guy who's been very outspoken in trying to restore the street performers' voluntary guidelines and end the sidewalk snatching laws, who is an international performer who actually is now over in Germany and be there for a number of months performing, gave us this kind of account of how she was involved in this. And it's not, I'm not trying to, you know, put
put up huge demon figures just to give a historically, what sounds to me like an interesting, but probably historically accurate account. In any case, Blake, the man who did the interviewing here, and I wish he'd written the, or spoken the actual time he was getting this and when this actually happened, because it's useful to actually know when and where these things happen, names of the police. That's something I encourage people who do these interviews, and I think it's a great interview. I'm glad that Blake did it, got this interview with Kid, as he calls himself. But it's good to get names, places, times, and so forth.
Do they have a number, the police?
I'm sorry, you were saying, Michael?
Do they have a police number on their shoulder that you can identify?
Oh, yeah, police have their badge numbers, and you know, it's, and you can get, and also they have name tags in Santa Cruz, so you can get the, sometimes a little hard to pronounce, usually not. But I just wanted to intervene with that brief kind of comment, which became less brief as it went on. It's illegal to sit down on the concrete lip around the trees. Have you seen the little trees on Pacific Avenue, the scrawny little trees that replaced the beautiful towering shrubbery and bushes that were there before? They were all torn out at the behest of the police department. Really, that was the main pressure group that was looking to remove all the shrubbery so they could surveil the mall more carefully. To hell with the quality of living and the quality of life, but let's make sure that surveillance is happening. Which always seems to be this kind of sick, sterile, relentless juggernaut imperative of police agencies. I mean, it's a sad thing, and it's, of course, gotten even more dangerous as drones and license identification and facial identification software become more, presumably more economical and more widespread. But if you dare to take a seat on, actually anywhere on the public sidewalk, other than at a bench, or on the 5% that is outside the forbidden zones, which take up, as I said, all the sidewalk, but very limited areas that are near the curb, and where it's uncomfortable to sit, usually. You can't sit on raised areas, stuff that's raised an inch or two off the ground, that the cement berms that surround the small trees. That's illegal, even though there's no sense in it being illegal. It's not damaging to anything. It's not terribly comfortable to sit there, but there's no reason one should do that, except that they want to make it give the police the option to drive away people they don't want downtown. That's the only, I could see, conceivable reason it was done. And it's a nasty, underhanded approach to the whole thing. Instead of, you know, openly coming out and saying, we don't want them neighbors downtown, and you notice I'm using the N-word. I use the word darky on a thread more recently, and I was criticized by an African American colleague of mine for using unacceptable language, and I replied to him, and I reply to people who don't like that kind of language. This is an attempt to clarify what is being done to homeless people here. They are the niggers of the 21st century. They are the Kaffirs of the 21st century. They are the kikes of the 21st century. Yes, my mother was Jewish, but I know what it means when you use that kind of a phrase in a political context. And I hope that people who are listening understand that too. So it's treating people as though they're second-class citizens is, maybe it's a perennial problem that will come up again and again. It probably is. Because when you have an unbalanced system where a lot of people are suffering, and they're suffering under the heel of a few who want to maintain their privileges and power, it's perhaps an easier matter to direct the fear and the anger and the concern to a group that's still lower in terms of more powerless, less resources, and kick them around and blame them and darkly criminalize them. On a good note, I want to note that I did get back from the police department today the results of a Public Records Act request, which gives the numbers of citations and the names of the people cited of everyone in 2012 and 2013 under the seven categories, which were propounded by Deputy Chief Steve Clark as part of his claim that there was a homeless crime wave and that there had to be, they're spending so much money on dealing with these homeless crimes, which, as I pointed out earlier, because they created the crimes. They aren't crimes. They're behaviors that are survival behaviors. They're life-sustaining behaviors in some cases. And it is the most abusive hypocrisy and the most rank cynicism to suggest that this is some kind of a, you created as a crime, and then, lo, you created a class of criminals, so you can say, that's a crime wave. We have to get rid of these criminals because we've declared all this activity as crime. So I will be, I'm passing this information on to others to look over. It's a lot of information. We're talking thousands of citations and thousands of arrests. I didn't get a full account of the addresses of the people who were cited, because that's very important, because if you look at these and you find that 95% of them are homeless, and that the people who are getting these citations for sleeping at night, camping, having camping equipment, even having an open container. And I remind you, having an open beer bottle is not behaving badly. It is simply having an open container. Ordinary people do it all the time in their houses or in the plush cafes downtown. It's only if you're poor, even in your own campsite, that it's a crime. So it's important to know just what crimes these people are accused of and just who is being accused and whether these are differentially and disproportionately impacting poor people. And I'm sending it back to the police department to get more information on that regard. Plus, of course, we need to see the broader picture. What about the real crimes? Assaults, murders, thefts, burglaries, arson, these issues, some of which I'm sure do involve homeless people. But how much, you know, compared to the general crime scene? That information has not been given out to us. And for damn good reason, because the agenda for the last year has been to go after homeless people. And that has been the agenda pushed, not because there's a real public safety concern. And although I cannot speak into the mind of Annalisa Cube or Michael Becker or others who are the Take Back Santa Cruz lights, I speculate that their real concern is the perception of crime, where if they see somebody who looks homeless, who's camped in the park across the street, illegally, it's illegal to be in a park at night, that is sufficient to raise not just their fear, but their indignation that such a thing can happen in our neighborhood. This kind of puffy bourgeois outrage outrages me. Mike, do you have any, you have something you wanted to say?
Just one comment. I saw on the paper the other day that of the homeless people, I don't know how that's defined, but 28% in the last year spent at least one day in jail. So I don't know how they define homeless, you know.
Well, the issue, of course, is why? Why were they jailed?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, maybe there is a theoretical argument that, yeah, these are all murderers, criminals and assaulters, or PPers in public, child molesters, and therefore they should be spending 50 days in jail, 100 days in jail, 6 months, 6 years.
Yeah.
But we have to know what exactly these so-called crimes are we can really come to a decision as to what's going on. And that information so far has not yet been clear, at least to me. Well, maybe Steve Clark, our deputy chief, knows about it, just isn't telling us yet, or at least it hasn't been revealed.
I think that most police would have no trouble throwing these people in jail for life if they could please the central council, you know,
I don't know that I am often very hostile. I'm hostile toward police as an institution frequently because of their regular abuses toward homeless people that aren't really a function of individual choices. It isn't really a function of mean cops. It's a machine. It is a machine that operates because police do what they're told to do. And I mean, it's kind of like I was watching a movie the other night called Hannah Arendt, which is about the famous philosopher Hannah Arendt, who was a Jewish refugee from World War II, who wrote about, she went to the Eichmann trial when Adolf Eichmann, the sort of the bureaucratic overseer of the Holocaust, the mass murder of the Jews in Germany, was kidnapped and taken to Jerusalem, tried and executed there in 1960, I think it was, or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And she wrote about, she went to the trial for the New Yorker magazine, apparently, according to this movie, and saw it and wrote about it. What she wrote about it was that Eichmann was just an ordinary person. He was no villain. He was this sort of rather nondescript little bureaucrat. And she said the real fear, the real terror of this all is the banality of evil. The fact how many ordinary people will do this without thinking. You and me included, Michael, all of us. Mm-hmm. Just when I talk about When I was accused of being racist for using the word darky in this sort of lampooning commentary about how homeless people are being treated like blacks were in the South and are still today mistreated. We are all racists, most of us, because we are not brought up in conditions that allow us to be otherwise. We don't choose to be racist, but we don't have friends who are Latino or African, usually at an early age. We aren't going to have coworkers closely that we work with. Some do. I mean, that's not always true.
But
communities tend to segregate a lot of it because of economic concerns and because of the fact that, you know, massive numbers of blacks disproportionately go to jail. Again, similar. I think a similar argument against as with respect to homeless can be made with respect to African Americans.
And if you have fear, you have to project it somewhere onto some person or group of people.
That can happen. And I'm just thinking, though, that, you know, we have this social sickness. And the police department is a similar situation. I don't think police officers, you were saying, oh, they could if they went to put all the homeless in jail. I don't think so. I think police officers, ironically, because they deal with homeless people so much, and not in the best way all the time, but they have to, you know, take the drunk down and take them out and take them back. You know, they actually have more contact than ordinary, the rest of us do. And so they come to know some people personally. And they come to realize this is not something that they really like to do. And that they also don't see it as being very effective either, I suspect. But the problem is then say, well, you know, just try to turn the hearts of your local police officer and, you know, appeal to them and they'll join the revolution or whatever. And no, I don't think so.
No, it's obviously a hard job that they have to do, dealing with these people all the time. But on the other hand, there's no excuse for the video I saw recently where six policemen were just like savage dogs beating up a
and then
a rabbit.
acquitted by
just,
the courts.
Total. So obviously skunks in our courts that acquit people like that.
Not there's skunks. It's ordinary people like you and me.
Well, how about judges that might be skunks?
The judge didn't do it. It was a jury that did it.
Jury,
and the reason
the
jury did it was because they were limited. They were told, and I see this blow here was appropriate, and this blow here was regulation. And that blow, notice how he raised his hand there. In other words, by using a very clever series, and I wasn't in the courtroom, so I can't really speak authoritatively about the Fullerton case. But courts are not a place where you get justice. That's one of the main problems.
Okay.
But it is a system of abuse that is the concern. And police officers are agents of that system. It doesn't mean that they don't, you know, they don't try to be human in their own way within that system.
Right.
I'm certain that they do in many ways. But in fact is you can't change by appealing to the humanity of a police officer. It doesn't change the system, and it doesn't change the imperatives that force them to keep doing what they're doing. They have a job to do. They're told what to do. They have an oath they've taken, you know, to follow this. I suppose they have an oath to uphold the Constitution too, but that isn't the main thing. The main thing is to follow the general orders of the police department, whatever it is, the orders of their superior. It's a paramilitary organization. And so, you know,
but they have to be held responsible for more respect for the people
I think
they
you
deal
should,
with.
Oh,
you
I
know?
Think you should always try to hold these both individual police officers and their higher ups. But that's not my point. My point is, first of all, you were saying that they want to see everybody in jail. I don't think they do, but I think that the problem is they will do that and put people in jail because they're ordered to.
Yeah.
And this massive abuse will continue regardless of how lovingly you are to them, how many times you kiss them, how low you bow, and how often you lick their boots. It's not going to make that much difference. Anyway. And this is not a call to, you know, engage in violent behavior toward police officers either. I think it's ill-advised because police officers are better armed. It's also, you're dealing with a broader community that's really the people you're appealing to. And middle-class communities in Santa Cruz are frightened of violence, unless it comes from the police, of course, and the military, in which case they can rationalize it because they've been trained to do that. You know, since they were 5 years, we've been trained to do that since we're 5 years old, to rationalize that kind of stuff.
As far as I can tell, the police all over the United States, we're becoming more and more a police state.
And why is that? I'm not quite sure. Are the laws becoming too strict, or are we just dumbed down? We can't fight back. I know in Tucson, where I live, every year, at least once a year, we have a parade against the police brutality.
We used to have one here, too.
Against the attitude of the police on the civilians. So I don't know, really.
Well,
know.
You should lead one this year, Michael.
It would be a good thing, because there is...
I think the National Police Abuse Day is in November. That's when we used to have it here.
Oh.
And it was, some years ago, it was a regular occasion, or at least it happened
yeah.
a couple of occasions. Let's hear some more, though, from William Blake right. and the interviews he did, and maybe even a little bit from the protest yesterday, if we can get to it.
It all depends. He might have a house, and, you know, the rules might be different for homeless vendors compared to vendors that don't have, that do have houses.
You know, we are entering the realm of speculation, but I would agree with that, because when I talked to him, he said Barnett was very nice, and he had no problems whatsoever with Barnett. And I said, well, I'm down here every day, and I got to say, he's a mean person, the way he talks and the way he behaves around homeless
people. Well, I can vouch for that. You know, I've
right.
seen it, you know.
So I have a feeling you're right, that he lives in a house and he's some, you know, regular guy. He's not getting as much harassment as if you're a street person.
Not to mention, you know, about an hour before he did this to you, I saw him down there and he seen me and he thought this was a camera, I guess, but he wound up taking off, you know, when he seen my, he looked over at me and then took off.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, he's definitely planned.
He doesn't like the media.
To do this. He's looking for anything to penalize me on, which, in a way, I mean, now I've got another ticket, which I got to wait another month for that to even get into the court.
But you know you can take a report and complain at the police department against him. You can put
no, that's not very effective.
Him.
A couple of comments. It used to be, and I've been reporting on free radio, you have to wait a month before going in to check for your citation. That is no longer seemed to be the case. At least it wasn't. When I checked the record of this woman, Kate Wenzel, we're listening to her. She's the scarf lady downtown who sells scarves. You may have seen her. She has gotten 3 citations, one for sleeping in her vehicle when she said she was not asleep. But even if she were asleep, why should she get a ticket in her vehicle for sleeping when there's no legal place to sleep in Santa Cruz and you have to sleep at night? Secondly, she got a ticket for selling without a business license 2 days before she got a business license, again from an officer who had been militantly pursuing her, this same CSO Barnett. And the third citation was another one by Barnett for not moving after an hour and going away for a full day from the spot she was at, even though she, I believe the claim is that she did do that. But the point was that it's a focused series of harassments on her. But I want to point out that if you get a citation now, you should check the courts within the next month, because apparently, at least in some cases, it's getting there much quicker. And there is this, I haven't seen any new updates on this, but Big Top Bob Lee, the DA, has declared before the Santa Cruz City Council that he is opening up a special office to collude with police officers, judges, sellouts from the Homeless Lack of Services Center and others to deal with the so-called 100 chronic offenders. That is to say, those who are getting the most sleeping tickets, the most sitting tickets, those they want to drive away from the downtown, who have been ignoring their citations and not attending to them, which means, of course, paying fines, going to court, doing stuff that you're likely to get ticketed for again unless you leave town or hide out very deeply. That's really kind of the lesson of all this. So go to you if you get a ticket, go find out what's going on with it. Doesn't mean you necessarily have to deal with it. You can also contact HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We do not really have a legal defense attorney, but we can give you some advice, and presumably on occasions we can be supportive in court by coming, which may or may not be to your benefit considering how HUF is regarded by the judges, but sometimes puts them on better behavior. Sometimes. So there's that. Let's hear some more from this conversation between Blake and Kate Wenzel from about a week or two ago.
But at least it's on the record. And once you do that, it's on the record.
You know, I'm going to just keep documenting what he's doing, because he's retaliating.
Well, not only that, but I would put a police report in, and that way, you know, it documents that, you know, what he just did.
Now, there are several things that to be said here. What I think William Blake here is talking about is
a complaint against the police department to their professional standards or internal affairs department. And this isn't necessarily a bad idea at all. It doesn't necessarily lead anywhere. It'll simply go on the guy's record for 5 years, even if it's as likely, very likely to be dismissed as either unsustained or unfounded or whatever. The only concern is if you have a crime that has been alleged against you, statements you make on a complaint can be used in court. So you have to be cautious about this. What you want to do is file a claim against the police officer if they have damaged you either physically or emotionally or removed your rights with this, and you have to do that within the 6 months after the incident occurs. You don't have to file a complaint. You can also file a complaint in the broadest way. You can say, I complain of, and then you say specifically what it is you feel the officer did. And then when the police department wishes to interview you on the subject, as they will often, you say, I'll talk to you afterward, if it's a criminal case against me, after that one is resolved. And we'll do it then. And then you also put in a claim against the city. These are kind of, it sounds like a lot of arcane details. And a lot of it is really running around footwork and paperwork, which only, the only value is it puts complaints on record. Which means that defense attorneys who have this officer being called as a witness against their clients can call up that record if the record involves violence or false statements, and they can bring you in as a witness that you observed this, and you can testify to the officer's lack of truthfulness or violent behavior insofar as it impacts another case. That's called a pitches motion in court. So, anyway, here's some more from the streets after my educational interruption. If you have any interruptions, you can call in, 427-3772.
You know?
Well, when I'm
because
not...
Because it's unfair treatment.
When I'm not working, I might do that, but at this point I have an advocate and representative who is fighting on my behalf.
Right. Only reason is it's on the record that way. You know?
Yeah.
All right, and this was Kate the Scarf Lady, Queen of Hearts, signing out. Another day in the life in Santa... Insanity Cruise.
Right.
It's 11:38 and out. Ciao. Sir William Blake here. It is at this time 2:05. I just moved my vehicle. It was not even a freaking hour and these guys chalked my tire. Hopefully I didn't get a ticket. I didn't see no ticket on the windshield, but these guys are starting to get to me because they look in my mirror of my window. They could probably see a sleeping bag, but doesn't mean I'm in the vehicle. But still with that, I'm being harassed because I don't get the normal allotted time for each parking lot. This parking lot was an hour. I wasn't even there an hour. And the other parking lots are 2 hours, and they're starting to say if I'm not a customer that I can't even park on their lot. So now we're dealing with another problem of what to do. So anyway, but I'll figure it out. It's no big deal, but that's a form of harassment too. Anyway, Sir William Blake, signing off, the eyes in the streets. Not that. And we're talking to Dreamcatcher.
Yes, we are. And things have been going really well in town. The cleanup's been going well. The police seem to be getting along with everybody pretty well. Well, everybody seems to be getting along with them. And we're kind of like getting it together here, out here. We got people participating, such as yourself. And I encourage that from all of us. And I think it's going to have some influence somewhere here that will be like self-perpetuating, you know, like a ripple with a gore, a tidal gore behind it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I was watching it this morning. It's fantastic. This river is magic. It flows like almost three directions at the same time.
That's true.
I was watching a cup on the bottom. Yeah. I was going, what the heck? It didn't look like a cup. It looked like something walking and moving.
Yeah.
You know? But the top of the water is going exactly the opposite. There's still secrets that are to be revealed around here. There's still treasure to be dug up. I think there's some ancient statisticity.
Yeah, but what about the streets?
The streets are cool, man. Come on, dude.
Well, I still see them making people put their bags outside, and stuff like that. And the purge is still kicking people out for no reasons.
Right.
Things like that.
Somebody wouldn't let me use the restroom the other day.
Now, who was that?
A restaurant that I was a customer at.
You want to name what restaurant or not?
No.
Okay, that's fine.
He did that with Robert. So.
Okay. It's cool.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And that restaurant is Los Pinos, the restaurant across from the town clock. I actually ran into Dreamcatcher shortly after he, I'm not sure how he avoided his bowels or took a piss when the restaurant, who he said he'd been a previously customer at quite regularly, wouldn't let him use the bathroom. This is the kind of thing that's humiliating, degrading, unsanitary, and abusive. And that I think is happening increasingly, or at least whenever I hear it happening, I want to make sure that it isn't going to happen again in that place unless there's, you know, some really good specific reason that it happens. I know my colleague here in the studio, Michael, is concerned about, I don't know, anger from homeless people or violent behavior from homeless people. I think that's a concern with anybody. Although, if you need to take a shit and that you're being denied access to a restroom, anger is quite an appropriate response in my view, and it's not something you need to be treated for. It's something that needs to be expressed in a very, you know, in an effective way. Perhaps I'll be taking a dump outside the restaurant. Although I think few people do this. I think it has been done on occasion. I'm not necessarily recommending a shit-in at city council, but or at the restaurants. But I think I can understand why someone would think of doing that.
Jeez, I just gave myself up.
See?
You got me. Hey, I don't know what I print there, but that's funny.
Queen's Royal...
It's going to be good. People are going to come.
The Queen of Hearts.
We're talking to who?
Her Royal Highness, the Queen of Hearts.
Okay.
And she is awarding her Royal Guard, the Queen's Royal Guard, with their badges of honor today. You get one, too. Let me get one real quick.
Sir Fox.
She's going to get her badge of honor. She's going to hit me with a scepter.
This is your badge of honor.
Cool.
Sir Blake. Sir William Blake. Sir.
She's applying the beautiful Valentine badge of honor.
And Sir Carl Fox. And then all we need next is Sir Dreamcatcher. And the Queen's Royal Guard is up for duty.
Cool.
You have a thick wrist.
I do.
There you go.
Strong dude.
It looks like Blake did a couple of extra curricular
interviews. Anything on the streets? Nothing? Anything?
Oh, I got a ticket for sleeping on my car last night.
Really?
This is Kate Wenzel's ticket for sleeping in her car.
Badge numbers.
Yeah, he told me. I asked him. It was 125 Aldridge, I think, and Ross, 134.
Yeah.
Someone called it in because they thought nefarious activity was happening in my car.
Oh, what? Snoring?
Yeah. I was sleeping. I was how nefarious
it
was.
Nefarious. What a criminal.
These TV soaked mine.
Sleeping in your car.
Taking shit up. And he said something like drugs or something. I said, I don't even smoke pot.
Yeah.
And he says, well, neither do I.
I can witness to that
okay,
one.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
right? You can witness
to
that
one. I can witness
Thank
to that
you.
One.
I don't even, I am like the cleanest living. Those people in the houses are most, no doubtedly,
I vouch
way
for
dirtier
that.
Living than me.
I vouch
so.
For that.
But I,
you know, it's just...
What an asshole. I mean, what an asswipe. I mean,
It was right. It was
what a high end of a donkey.
It was when the clock struck midnight on Love Day, so it was a real Cinderella moment.
Oh, that
right
was
there,
nice,
you know?
Nice
yeah.
of the idiot.
Yeah, sleeping in my car by myself.
Yeah, nice
Michael
idiot.
Loser.
Yeah. What a, he's the loser. Well, that sucks.
Well, they were my Valentine. You know, instead of a red rose, they brought me a ticket.
Yeah, nice of that.
It was romantic.
Oh, that was really nice of the moron.
Yeah. The last romantic thing he said to me was, find another spot.
Oh, wow.
And I replied lovingly, what are your names?
Yeah.
That's what my last girlfriend said to me when we broke up.
And we were
so you're
speaking
on duty
to
today.
And we were
Queen of Hearts.
The Queen
also
of Hearts.
Also known as Garf Lady, also known as Kate.
That's right. Nice talking to you, Kate.
You too. Yeah. That's our blade.
Queen of Hearts.
Queen of Hearts.
That's right.
How does that help you?
Really? Yeah, because that's what the rules are. But you obviously don't want to follow them.
No, you obviously don't use discretion on how to actually create an environment.
Yeah, I know.
Here. You
and we got the recording going. Okay, I'm giving it, letting you know. It's now 10:22.
This is
Kate Wenzel.
And this is Officer Barnett in a conversation with Kate Wenzel, the officer who has given her the two tickets. One for not moving along, and another for... with being without a business license, which she wasn't able to get because the offices were closed several days before, according to her account, and which she then got 2 days later. And which she's still being harassed about, as I understand it.
And you're being told that you have to move in an hour. If you haven't moved in an hour, I'll come back to give you a citation. Thank you very much.
Okay, this is great. Can't wait. Bring it on.
And it's interesting that that statement by Officer Barnett is simply not an accurate statement of the law. The law states that if after an hour you haven't moved, and then you are informed after that hour that the hour is up and you haven't moved, and you still refuse to move, then you get a citation. It doesn't require you to time yourself so that you know that you're not there for more than an hour. So it sounds like Barnett is either intentionally or ignorantly misusing this ordinance. And... let's hear a little more. This is the first actual recording I've heard of Officer Barnett.
Go ahead. So as I was walking down the street, I saw there were two police officers speaking to a man who was just simply sitting next to the bathroom. As I approached, that man seemed to be very subdued, quiet, not doing anything wrong, just sitting there. And the police were both kind of huddled around him in a menacing kind of fashion, speaking with him, just kind of harassing for sitting there, which I find to be repugnant.
They've done
people
the same
should be able to sit since
sure.
everyone pays taxes on the streets. We share that. It's public. It's
right.
nothing but we should be able to sit down.
Agreed.
But, you know, other than that, I've also seen people with bags harassed over other people, especially smoking cigarettes downtown. The people who have a bag are obviously going to be targeted and the others
right.
not. And
sure.
they're cops walk right by those folks.
Yeah. True.
I'm seeing a lot of different kinds of targeting and just kind of like stalking the way the police come around here.
They do.
Through with the first response, then the hospitality people.
Right.
And then they come through with the real cops when they like have rounds on them now.
Yeah.
When they feel like they can't make a move.
Now, did you see this guy's badge number? Because I got all his badge numbers.
I don't. It was two officers, a male and a female officer, and I'd seen them earlier when they responded to a real situation that happened at Peace Coffee, where this man who was obviously somewhat insane and disabled in some fashion was threatening other people there, and they asked him to leave, and he wouldn't leave immediately, which was legit. They showed up and were really legit about the whole situation. But when it came to the other people that I've seen,
They weren't.
But I'm just saying, like, I'm not prejudicing.
No, I understand.
I'm just saying, like, I've noticed things.
But the situation
I know the difference between harassment and, like, trying to help somebody.
The second one was mishandled.
It's real easy to see, especially if you're carrying a big backpack down there.
Yeah, that's true.
It's real easy to watch.
Yep. Well, anyway, I appreciate that story.
Yeah. I hope that helps, man.
I appreciate that.
I appreciate you. Keep up the good work.
Let's see.
talking to Kate again about Officer Burnett and pointed she's being fingered out. I don't think this is correct. Anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead.
He definitely targeted me this morning. The policy has been on the one-hour enforcement complaint-driven only, and only pretty much on the musicians. The only time ever it was used on the vendors was Christmas Eve, because there were so many vendors out. And at that point, the police would come and tell us, you need to move now.
But that still was illegal, since you already had, you know, they weren't supposed to enforce the permit till after Christmas.
This isn't about the permit. This is about the moving everyone every hour. This is part of the ordinance change. But the thing is, the police came and told us when we needed to move. They didn't tell us, you have to move it in an hour, and if we come back, we will give you a ticket. Like, we have to self-regulate ourselves. So what Barnett did today was particularly target me, being the only vendor out on the street today. There was no reason to use that. There was no complaint called in on me, as far as I know. He didn't say there was. And I even said, this is usually only complaint-driven, and he didn't respond to the fact that I said that. And then making me regulate myself, saying, if I come back in an hour and you're still here, then I will give you a ticket. And then the other thing was, we noticed I was the only vendor on the street, but there was a musician nearby named Dave playing his mandolin. He was there before I arrived, and then I set up. Barnett came and told me I had to move in an hour, and then after an hour, I moved, and Dave was still there for about another hour, still playing, and I asked him when he was leaving if Barnett told him he needed to move, because the hour was up, and he said Barnett never told him he had to move. So he's targeting me in particular, because he didn't ask one other person nearby to move every hour. And I believe the reason he's targeting me is because I have an advocate who sent him an email yesterday naming him in a case that he's mounting. And the fact that he said my name into this recorder, Kate Wenzel, very specifically, is interesting to me, because I've never told him my name was Kate. I never told him my name. The only time I gave him my name was on my ID that I had to give him the first time he ticketed me, which was also... anyway, that was a different story. But he saw my name. It would be Catherine Wenzel. And in any official documents that I gave him, it was Catherine, not Kate. So he's getting my name possibly from the email he received or from other people. But that he would say that my name was that is interesting, because he's got me targeted. He's got me in his mind as someone to target.
Yeah.
That was my experience today.
Okay. And that was Kate, the Scarf Lady, Queen of the Hearts, Queen of Valentine,
the
Love Day Princess, the Queen of All, Kate.
And it's interesting and encouraging to hear that people on the streets, Kate specifically, are becoming more sophisticated in their understanding of these laws. I mean, she said exactly the same thing I did. And I can say it all I want in a radio show weeks later, but the person who's actually undergoing the experience to understand it and realize it at the time raises my hopes that there can be a really adequate counter-response to this. Of course, what we need is someone with a video camera videoing Barnett going after her, the dialogue that you heard a little bit of, with her, and then an interview with David, the mandolin player, stating that he'd been there, he saw Barnett walk past, Barnett ignored him, went directly to Kate, Barnett passed him several times, if that happened, knew he was there, and didn't go after him at all. Now, frequently the argument that will be used by police officers, they had something more important to do. But gathering this kind of evidence, slowly, but persistently, and then putting it on YouTube and putting it on the air and amassing it is the way to go. Some say you should take it to an attorney and do a long lawsuit. And if you can actually find an attorney to do that, that would be fine. But just take the case, for example, of Officer Hernandez, who went after Jasmine and her husband, Shade, and her mother, Babushka, he pulled a gun on them, according to their account, at the Salvation Army at 2 days before Thanksgiving, taking a plate of food outside, which others had done, but apparently Hernandez felt that was inappropriate for them to do, and then laughed about it and then essentially mocked them later. And completely unprofessional behavior, if in fact the account is accurate. They have went to the police station. They made a report. The police are sequestering the reports. You can't find the reports. They haven't been able to get. We haven't been able to get the reports, nor have the victims, the people who were victimized, as they reported it by Hernandez, been able to get the reports. And the idea that they're waiting for an attorney, which I don't think they've found yet, similar to the problem with Richard Hardy, was slammed face down to the sidewalk by Officer Vasquez on videotape, and you can find it on YouTube, last spring. It's much better to publicize it immediately, my tendency is to publicize it. But I also understand that if you've got a criminal case pending, you know, you can compromise your criminal case, and that people can get sort of nervous about doing that. We're almost at the end of our hour. If you have any comments or thoughts and you want to call in, you better do it now, 427-3772. I'll be back on Sunday at 9:30 in the morning, most likely. There's a Food Not Bombs meal both Saturday and Sunday now, 2 days a week, 4 o'clock at the main post office area, actually on the sidewalk outside the main post office. So I encourage people to check it out. Any other thoughts, Mike, before we move on?
No, I think that I'm satisfied right now.
Well, good. In that case, we'll hear a little bit more, and then we'll be gone. And upcoming next is From the Cream to the Dregs with the infamous, gruff, but beloved by many, Uncle Dennis. So stay tuned. If you want to catch me off air, do give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. We are in area code 831 in case you're calling from out of the area.
And by the way, Alex is selling in an illegal spot right now. He's within 14 feet of a bench, but has not been reprimanded.
And who is this Alex?
Oh, he sells art. And Maria is sitting, she's been there for more than an hour, and Barnett has not asked her to move either.
Yeah.